Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Now, I want to talk at this stage about the Lazarus Heist podcast. It's a brilliantly entertaining telling of the diplomatic fallout that ensued when Sony Pictures advertised the release of a pretty tame and not particularly hilarious Seth Rogen comedy called The Interview back around 2015. In the film, James Franco and Seth Rogen are sent to assassinate the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. In North Korea, that's the kind of no-no that would almost definitely lead to public execution. Anyway, the authoritarian Hermit Kingdom, they responded with a massive destructive hack on Sony Pictures, leaking gigabytes of embarrassing email conversations and more or less annihilating every aspect of its electronics. And the lead actors, by the way, were offered bodyguards. But I mean, all of this is really just the intro to the story of the 4.5 hour podcast, The Lazarus Heist, which is one of the most extraordinary stories of our time. Put together by Jeff White, the man responsible, is with us now on the phone. So thanks a million for joining us today on the programme. Where to start? I mean, like, okay, let's go back then to 2014. About the Sony hacks. A bunch of confidential information was leaked, including personal data of 4,000 employees and emails also that produced kind of juicy details about major celebs. Take it up from there, Jeff.
Yeah, well, it was a quite remarkable hack. And I should say Sony was simply one in a series of hacks carried out, according to investigators, by North Korea's elite hacking group, as you've said, the Lazarus Group. So there were telltale signs before 2014, before Sony. They've been hitting various targets, but Sony really put them on the map. And what was incredible about it was a sort of twofold attack. As you say, they managed to break into Sony's computer systems. They did this, depressingly enough, by sending the kind of dodgy emails a lot of us get, the kind of phishing emails. Somebody inside Sony fell for one of those phishing emails, and that's how the hackers got in. What they did next was they basically took the place apart. They crashed computers. They wiped data. At one point, things got so bad that, you know, Sony staff were resorted to using pens and pencils. They couldn't even send faxes and do photocopies because everything, all the computers were networked. But then there was this second phase, which you've talked about, where having, you know, digitally annihilated the company, they then set about leaking the information that they'd stolen. And what's remarkable about that is they didn't just dump all the information online, as a lot of computer hackers do. They very carefully sectioned off what they'd stolen to make sure it had the maximum effect. And they sort of built up to a crescendo with this. They started emailing journalists directly. So journalists received emails from the computer hackers saying, hey, we've got some information for you from Sony. You know, why didn't you do this story? Why didn't you cover that story? And what they were building up to was the leaked emails of the two people who ran Sony, the two most powerful people in Hollywood. And one of them was forced to resign as a result when incredibly damaging emails came out about Amy Pascal, co-chairperson.
Yeah, that's right. But I mean, like, what we're nearly talking about here is Hell Hath No Fury than Little Rocket Man Scorned, because like, there's so much about this. Can we jump forward to around, say, 2016? And we'll go back probably as well. A North Korean hacker, $1 billion raid on a Bangladesh national bank. Why are the two of these stories connected?
Well, it's interesting. So the hack, as you say, on Bangladesh Bank started actually in January 2015. It's only a few months after the Sony hack went public. And a number of employees at Bangladesh Bank, again, depressingly, started getting, you know, dodgy emails through from people as a job hunter saying, oh, could you look at my CV? And in that email was the computer virus, which got the hackers into Bangladesh Bank. Once there, again, they squirreled around the network. They sniffed around the network. And they came across the computers that control Bangladesh Bank's money. And we should make clear, when we say Bangladesh Bank, this isn't just a bank in Bangladesh. Yeah. It's the central financial institution. It's like the Bank of England, basically, in Bangladesh. They have access to billions of dollars. And the hackers decided to steal a billion of it from Bangladesh Bank's account in New York, and then spirit it away using, we'll come on to this probably, but casinos in the Philippines. And
yeah, I do want to get into that. The problem is the detail of just this hack and exactly what happened could take us an hour, and it's so interesting. But I don't know. Like, I mean, you might as well just give me a little bit of the malfunctioning printer on the 10th floor, and, you know, and just tell me what happened there.
Yes, well, this was really the first clue Bangladesh Bank had that it had been hacked. When the bank made transfers of its millions and millions and billions of dollars, there was a computer printer that printed out sort of backup copies of those. You know the way some people, they don't trust emails and computers. They always like to have something, you know, printed out as a hard copy. Well, Bangladesh Bank was the same. They had a little printer that printed out copies of the transactions, say, you know, well, you have just sent X amount of money to this person over here. So one of the employees comes in, he's working on a weekend, and the printer's out of action, and it's one of those headaches you get in an office, oh, bloody printer's broken, you know, we're going to have to get the IT guys in, you know, people. Yeah. And then they set about trying to fix it. It doesn't really work. So they come back the next day and they have no idea, in fairness, what's gone on behind the scenes. It's only when they come in the next day and they manage to fix the printer that the printer starts suddenly spewing out these records of transactions. And they start looking at these and thinking, oh, we didn't send this money. And they suddenly realize that somebody's got into their systems, has dispatched a whole bunch of money. And it's only now that the computer printer is starting to get to alert them to the crime. And that's when things really...
More detail in terms of the way they did it on a Thursday evening with holidays the next day in one country and another Monday holiday in New York and all this kind of stuff. It's like, so they had 5 days basically before anything was properly kind of uncovered in one way. But we're talking here about a very audacious cyber attack, stealing $1 billion, right? And like, North Korea is largely disconnected from the global community in just about every way, technologically, economically and everything else. So we're talking here, and this is like Village of the Damned territory, or it's like, you know, like a bunch of little kids kind of being cyber trained to do whatever it is needs to be done. But I mean, it is a shadowy team of hackers and middlemen across Asia operating with the support of the North Korean regime.
That is certainly the allegation from both the United Nations and also the FBI and various other security researchers as well. I mean, there's the obvious sort of motivation. You know, have you got the motive to do this? And Sony releasing this film, The Interview, it did not go down well in North Korea. So yeah, I guess motive plus opportunity. You know, North Korea, as you say, has very skilled hackers, and people underestimate the skill of North Korea's hackers. That sounds very terrifying, that North Korea's got government hackers. Well, you know, frankly, everybody, the UK does, America does, you know, most governments now employ hackers. What's different about North Korea is, for various reasons which you sort of explore in the podcast, the country is extremely short of money. They've got a financial crisis, constant financial crisis. So I guess the motivation for going after someone like Bangladesh Bank would be that they can actually steal money and spirit it away over borders. But yeah, this is a very, very skilled group of computer hackers that they've got there.
Okay, but like, we're talking here about thousands cultivated from childhood to become cyber warriors. I know it really does sound like, you know, a dystopian movie of some sort. They're very talented mathematicians as young as 12 years of age. They're taken from schools, sent to the capital, intensive tuition, morning and night, etc. And would it be fair to say that the Sony hack was the precursor? Like, they realised, if we can do this, we can now do this.
I think it really put them on the map. I mean, you've got to realize one of the things about North Korea is it punches above its weight. It's fair to say, you know, one of the reasons North Korea hangs on to its nuclear weapons with all the attendant problems of that is because North Korea wants to have a seat at the table. They want to sit with the big boys, and nuclear weapons is a way of doing that. What's interesting about the Sony hack is suddenly Barack Obama is mentioning it, who was obviously then president at the time. Sony is being dragged through the mud. It's getting worldwide headlines. I think that was the moment possibly where North Korea and its hackers, if indeed they are behind this, as many people claim, thought to themselves, wow, we can really make waves. Yeah. We can really do some damage reputationally.
I mean, we're amongst the 12 poorest nations in the world, but look what we can do. And in fact, if in any way it comes from the very, very top, as is the allegation, and they see what they can do, is every penny they might take, steal or whatever, put into this nuclear program. It's not exactly given out to the people, as I say, one of the 12 poorest nations in the world.
No, exactly. There is, let's be honest, not a sort of receipt that's signed by Kim Jong-un saying, you know, thank you for your stolen money. I'm now going to spend this on nuclear weapons. But since the 90s, North Korea's had a policy of military first, which is basically the money, the resources, the attention, the kudos goes to the military. It's a highly militarized society, millions and millions in their army. It's one of the largest standing armies in the world. It is almost inevitable that the money that gets taken in these raids, again, if the FBI is right, it is North Korea, that money will filter back into the military and inevitably filter into the nuclear weapons program.
Yeah, okay. So you mentioned like January 2015, an innocuous email comes in looking for a job or giving their CV or whatever it is. At least one person downloads it. That's all you need. And then everything can be kind of infected, if that's the right word. So they were there. The baddies in this case here, they were there for a year inside the Bangladesh computers. Does that just show how clever they are or the patience they have?
Partly, yes. I mean, it is an astonishing amount of time to lurk in a bank's systems, because the problem is any time they could have been discovered and shut out, or Bangladesh Bank might have just got new computers and you know, erased their viruses. Partly it's about their stealthiness and their ability to linger. One of the things they did, which is fascinating, was once they'd infected one computer and moved on to a more important computer, they'd erase their viruses on that first computer. So they were covering their tracks they went along to give a minimal footprint. But the other thing they had to do is, you know, you're going to steal $1 billion. What are you going to do? Transfer it to Kim Jong-un's personal account. No, you have to try and disguise and launder that money. And so actually what they spent the year doing, it seems, was setting up different money laundering routes around the world, mainly in the Philippines.
A way to dispose it, exactly, or a way to put it through and clean the money, like in the old mafia movies. So,
exactly.
35 transfers are thereabouts, around 951 million in total. We're talking here a Hollywood heist movie then, because a single simple mistake. What was that?
Yes. So they went after, as you say, $951 million, which was pretty much the entire amount that Bangladesh had in its New York account. Now, we talked about the fact that they needed to send this money somewhere. And the place they picked was the Philippines, partly because Monday, the 8th of February, 2016 was a bank holiday in the Philippines. So in addition to all of the weekend and the time and everything they gave themselves, they had an extra day because it was bank holiday in the Philippines. So by the time it all got discovered, people were phoning the Philippines and no one was answering because it was a bank holiday there. But the place they picked in the Philippines to do this was a little bank branch in a place called Jupiter Street, which is in the capital, Manila. Now, they could have picked loads and loads of other banks. They could have picked any other bank, really. But they managed to choose that bank for reasons we go into in the podcast. And that word, Jupiter, was what derailed them. Because unknown to them, by pure coincidence, the word Jupiter was the name of a shipping vessel which was sanctioned by the US because of links to Iran, which is also under sanctions. So as soon as they tried to transfer the money to Jupiter Street, this branch, in the New York Bank, the New York Fed, that rang alarm bells because just Jupiter just flagged, just automatically triggered their systems. And somebody started looking at these transactions and thinking, hang on, this is very weird. So of the $951 million, $81 million gets through to the Philippines. Still a huge amount of money, though.
Absolutely, but there's a very good chance that this would not have been investigated if that mistake hadn't been made or if that unfortunate coincidence hadn't occurred. So, you know, what they want to do is make the trail very muddy and very obscure and all that. And, now we get to what you vaguely referred to earlier on, this casino in Manila, this gleaming white palace of hedonism. Tell me about that.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, well, the money gets transferred to bank accounts, but the problem with that is you can still trace it. You've got the bank account numbers, as a record, as a paper record, you know, you've got to get the money to the point where it can't be tracked down or it can't be traced back to the crime. So you need, it's like in the old Western movies where the cowboy's trying to escape and he, you know, takes his horse and they cross a river so that, you know, the footprints of the horse on one side of the river don't match the other side. It's exactly that. You're looking for that, you know, kind of opportunity. A casino is the ideal place because they're used to handling millions of dollars, particularly casinos in the Philippines, big casino scene. And as I've said, it was a Lunar New Year, bank holiday New Year celebration. And so there's lots of people in town gambling. So they took the money to a casino and then they gambled it back and forth over the casino tables. And it's quite difficult then as an investigator to say, OK, that dollar bill that went into that casino and was then gambled matches this dollar bill that's just walked out of the casino with the person and their winnings.
And casino chips come into play here and back into cash and play Baccarat, the easy one, and Bob's your uncle. Now, on that, I tell you, we're only like giving the headlines here. We're not giving any details. You've got to listen to the 4.5 hours or thereabouts. It's 11 programmes altogether in the Lazarus Heist, which is the BBC podcast. Now, let's just go to one more thing here, which is another detail. Tell me about the super dollars. What happens here?
Oh, yes. Yeah, this predates by quite a margin the computer hacking thing. This is a more traditional, more old school type of crime. So during the 90s, the US started to see very, very accurate fake $100 bills, counterfeit bills turning up. So good were these fakes that actually in some ways they were better than the originals. The printing was clearer than on the originals. So they started trying to track the origin of these $100 bills. Because you've got to realize that the US, counterfeiting in the US has a very long history. So during the Civil War, there were estimates of a third to a half of all notes were counterfeit. So counterfeit worry and the corrosive trust worry that it has is a huge concern in the US. So you start tracing these notes back, and sure enough, they start appearing and popping up overly frequently in the hands of North Korean diplomats working abroad. So they start passing off these notes, they get caught with them, putting them into banks and so on. The US allegation is that North Korea wasn't just handling these notes, they were actually printing them. They were actually printing fake notes in order partly to generate income for the country, but also perhaps to destabilize the US by undermining its currency.
Okay, so at this stage then, we're talking here about, you know, as I say, you know, one of the 12 poorest nations in the world. They've got some of the world's most kind of, I don't know, great hackers cultivating elite cyber warfare units and all the rest of it, etc. So Kim Jong-un himself, he was sold to his people as a kind of a champion of science and technology, wasn't it? And like, in one way, that's this might be how he funds nuclear weapons, allegedly, obviously. But I mean, they can't freely connect to the global internet in that country. So, you know, the most talented, as I say, are sent abroad to China. Now, the Sony attack might have been a dry run for the 2016 Bangladesh bank heist, but Bangladesh trying to get its money back, what does it do there, and does it get any back?
It does. There is a little bit of good news in this story. So Bangladesh obviously freaks out when it realizes what's happened and starts sending delegations of people to the Philippines, which is where most of the money's ended up. They managed to get back, I think it's $16 million from one of the people who was involved in this whole casino business, who hung on to the money and handed that back. So they did get back $16 million. But the rest of the money, they are still, as far as I'm aware, trying to trace it down, and proceedings are ongoing, as the classic phrase goes. But it's been 5 years now.
Yeah, right, indeed. But I mean, now it's been 5 years, but where are we now? Because computer hacking and global money laundering and cutting edge cryptocurrency and thefts, etc., they have the technical skill, North Korea. But if this is a tiny, desperately poor nation that can silently reach into the email and bank accounts of the rich and the powerful, this is pretty heavy stuff, isn't it? I mean, I presume we're going towards cryptocurrency next, are we?
Yeah.
And that's going to be 10 times harder for us to check it out.
It really is. It really is, for a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, for a start, North Korea has, like a lot of countries, sealed off its borders in the pandemic. You can imagine what would happen if coronavirus got widespread within North Korean society. The effect would be horrific. So cryptocurrency offers the possibility of taking money literally through the internet and transferring money through the internet and stealing it digitally. You don't even need to touch the ground. You don't even need to go anywhere to do that necessarily. The other thing about cryptocurrency is we're still working out how regulated it is. I mean, Bangladesh Bank, the national bank of Bangladesh, is very regulated, and there's a whole community of people who oversee its actions and so on. These cryptocurrency exchanges, they're sort of outside the traditional financial system. So yes, they get hacked and they get stolen from, but who picks up the tab and who follows that through? And also, as you say, with the laundering, there are entire dark web websites devoted to the practice of laundering cryptocurrency and washing that money. If you thought the story we told about the casinos in the Philippines was complex, the cryptocurrency stuff is off the hook complicated. Yeah. And for investigators, it can be really hard to get that back. I mean, the couple of cryptocurrency heists we've seen recently, they've been lucky because the hackers have given the money back.
Yeah,
you know, that's the only way you get it back.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, I'll tell you what. I mean, this, as I say, is just, you know, the outline. Really, you should check it all out. It's about 4.5 hours. It's 11 programmes. It is The Lazarus Heist. And
I should say it's 10 programmes. I don't want to disappoint your listeners. It's 10.
Did I not listen to an 11th? No.
We are making more episodes. There are more to come.
Well, so I'd say you will with the cryptocurrency, all right. You'll be making them for the next 10 years. Yeah. Anyway, we're talking here about a murky nexus of crime, espionage and nation-state power mongering and just mad carry-on, basically. And it's all there in the Lazarus heist. So thank you very much, Jeff, for talking to us on the program. Do I say that people can get the podcast wherever they get their podcasts?
Exactly, we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, it's on YouTube, it's also on BBC Sound. So anywhere you want to look, it'll be there.
Good luck with your ongoing work. Thank you so much, Jeff, for talking to us on the programme today.
Thank you.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.